Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 691, The Confederate Secret Service and the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This program has been recorded on September 26th of the year 2009. The year 2009 has not only seen the assumption of office by the first African-American president, it also, fittingly, is the 200th, the 200th anniversary of the birthday of Abraham Lincoln. And what we're doing in this program is taking a look at the real circumstances surrounding President Lincoln's assassination. Far from being the work of a lone fanatic, assisted by a few other lone fanatics, a group of lone nuts, so to speak, which is how history has recorded it, in fact, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln was a covert operation that was conducted by the Confederate Secret Service. The initial plans called to capture Lincoln and kidnap him and bring him to the Confederacy as a way of forcing the Union to sue for peace. And then later, after the relatively surprised surrender of Lee's army at around Richmond, and basically outside of Richmond and the surrender at Appomattox, the plan changed to one to kill Abraham Lincoln, as well as Vice President Andrew Johnson and Secretary of State William Seward, in order to force throw the Union into a state of political confusion and giving the Confederate Army still in the field, and they were considerable, a chance to regroup and fight on. But again, John Wilkes Booth was not only a Confederate secret agent, but the operation, which ultimately morphed into his killing rather than capture, was a full-blown Confederate Secret Service operation authorized from the highest levels of the Confederate Secret Service by Confederate President Jefferson Davis. What we're going to look at, again, we're going to resume the narrative with where we left off in Side 1. The book from which all of our information comes is called Come Retribution, The Confederate Secret Service and the Assassination of Lincoln. It is published in softcover by the University of Mississippi Press and authored by William A. Tidwell with the assistance of James Hall and David Winfred Gaddy. And again, the book copyrighted 1988. And we're going to resume with the actual planning of the operation. The planning involved not only the moving of various Confederate secret agents into place for the operation, notably Thomas Conrad, among others, but the use of Colonel John Mosby, the Gray Ghost, and Mosby's Rangers as one of the principal elements in setting up the security force that was to harass the Union pursuers who were anticipated to mount an operation to rescue the captured President Lincoln. There was also the setting up of a fund here, and also operations out of one of the principal planning centers, which was Montreal, Canada. We're also going to note here that two of the principal people involved, not only in the coordination of the mission from Montreal, but also in the selection of an ad hoc division, some of whose units or some of whose personnel were to comprise that undercover security force in Virginia, where these were two relatives of General Robert E. Lee, one of which a cousin and another of which was one of his sons. More about that in a minute. But of the actual setting up of this operation, we read from Come Retribution by Tidwell, Hall, and Gaddy. On September 15, 1864, the Confederate Secretary of War issued an order directing Colonel Mosby, the partisan leader in Northern Virginia, and Lieutenant Charles H. Kaywood, the commander of the Signal Corps camp in King George County, Virginia, to cooperate with Confederate agent Captain Thomas N. Conrad on his mission. Conrad was given $400 in gold by Secretary of State Judah Benjamin with President Davis's approval and left on the 17th of September for the northern neck of Virginia, the area between the Potomac and Rappahannock Rivers, with a party of Secret Service and Signal Corps personnel. It would appear that there were discussions with Conrad in Richmond between September 12th and September 15th of 1864 of a plan to capture President Lincoln. This could well have been the meeting that approved a draft plan, and Conrad's mission to Washington could have been part of the next phase to make the plan more specific. On September 13th, Mosby organized a new company in his battalion of partisans and appointed one of General Lee's principal agents, Walter Bowie, as a lieutenant in that company. In late September, he sent Bowie with 25 men to conduct an unprecedented raid into southern Maryland, crossing in the vicinity of Kaywood's Signal Corps camp. The Bowie operation was so out of character for Mosby that it may have been a deliberate test of the feasibility of moving a small armed unit through southern Maryland. This was one of the routes that any party with a captive Lincoln would have had to take. Exiting on the west of the District of Columbia, the party ran into trouble, and Bowie was killed. Conrad was in Washington by late September and devoted considerable time and effort to observing the movements of President Lincoln and ascertaining the best location to seize him and the best route to follow with him as a captive. John Wilkes Booth began in September to recruit a team to help him capture Lincoln. In mid-October, he went to Montreal, Canada, where he met Confederate agents who may have played some role in the direction of the action part of the plan against Lincoln. In November of 1864, Booth returned to Washington. There's no indication that he and Conrad actually met, but they were in Washington simultaneously for several days before Conrad left to report his findings to Richmond. In late September, an Episcopal minister, the Reverend Dr. Kenzie John Stewart, made a trip from Canada into the Confederacy. Stewart was related by marriage to the family of General Lee. He had served as a chaplain under General Winder, who managed one of the Confederate organizations involved in clandestine operations. In 1863, Stewart had gone to England and later to Canada. His correspondence and other documents reveal that he was involved in some secret activity with President Jefferson Davis and other Confederate agents in Canada. In October of 1864, he left Canada and went to Baltimore, traveled through southern Maryland, and crossed the Potomac in a makeshift boat at the spot that Booth later planned to use as the crossing with the captive Lincoln. He went to Kaywood's Signal Corps camp, where he wrote to General Lee. He later went to Richmond, conferred with President Jefferson Davis, visited Robert E. Lee, and returned to Canada after having been allocated $20,000 in Secret Service funds personally by President Davis. Because of Stewart's past association with some of the critical geography involved in Booth's planned escape route, and because of his high-level contacts, it's possible that he may have been involved in planning part of the Lincoln operation. On September 23, 1864, Colonel Edwin Gray Lee, a cousin of General Robert E. Lee, was promoted to Brigadier General. Lee had been involved in clandestine operations earlier in the war, and in December of 1864 he was sent to Canada to take over some of the Confederate undercover work from Jacob Thompson and Clement C. Clay, the commissioners who had been operating there since the spring of that year. One cannot eliminate the suspicion that his promotion may have been related to decisions made at the presumed meeting of September 12th through 15th in Richmond. On October 20th of 1864, Brigadier General G.W.C. Custis Lee, General Robert E. Lee's oldest son, was promoted to Major General. Curtis had been one of the leaders of the abortive Point Lookout raid in July. Now he was given command of another ad hoc task force, a synthetic, unquote, division made up of various reserve units in Richmond and some troops in a quiet part of the defensive line east of Richmond. Some of these troops appear to have been used later to provide security for the escape route that Booth was planning to use. One suspects that Custis Lee's promotion was related to the planning for the Lincoln operation. Lieutenant Blackford, the engineer, was ordered to Richmond for a meeting during the first week of November of 1864. As a result of this meeting, he did not finish mapping some of the area originally assigned, but instead began to work on a map of King William County, an area that would have been of importance to a different route for the action party with a captive Lincoln. This change of Blackford's assignment indicates that there had been a change in the plan for the escape route. Instead of going south through territory controlled by Colonel Mosby, the route on which Bowie had run into trouble, the action party would now exit through southern Maryland and possibly go by water up the Rappahannock River. Lieutenant Kaywood, the senior officer of the Signal Corps in the Northern Neck, was in Richmond at this time and could have participated in a meeting at which the escape route was discussed. In November, Booth went into southern Maryland and began to organize an escape route through that area. On November 5, 1864, the Confederate War Department established a fund in the Treasury Department of $250,000 for the purpose of paying officers and soldiers passing through Richmond on furlough. This, was enough money to pay the salaries of about 1,500 officers and men for 6 months. No similar fund had been established before. Why was it needed now? The establishment of this fund followed closely on the heels of Custis Lee's promotion to Major General. We believe that both actions related to the provision of a security force for Booth's escape route. Naturally, if the Confederates were planning to capture President Lincoln, they would also have to plan to receive him in Confederate territory and defend the Action Party against pursuit. The escape route that Booth was working on led to the northern neck of Virginia. This was a no-man's land between the Potomac and Rappahannock rivers. The appearance there of organized forces from either side would likely provoke a reaction from the other side. The Confederacy could not overtly establish a security force there without risking increased Union interest in the area. The answer was to establish a security force there covertly. To accomplish this, men from regiments recruited in the Northern Neck were sent home, quote, on furlough, unquote. Once at home, as we shall see, they were organized into ad hoc units to patrol the area and to be ready to repel a Union raid. These may well have been the officers and soldiers on furlough to be paid from that special fund. And what we're going to look at next is the Montreal base for much of the planning for the Lincoln operation. Again, initially, ostensibly, a plan to capture Abraham Lincoln and force the North to sue for peace. Then after Lee's relatively surprised surrender, this turned into a plan to kill Abraham Lincoln as well as Vice President Johnson and Secretary of State William Seward in order to throw the northern political leadership into disarray and give the South a chance to successfully regroup. More about that in a minute. Of the use of Montreal as a primary planning center for the Lincoln operation, we read, in Chapter 12, we left John Wilkes Booth in room 150 at the St. Lawrence Hotel in Montreal. He signed in at 9:30 p.m. on October 18th of 1864. There's no way to learn the names of all those persons Booth saw during his 10-day stay. That city had a growing contingent of Confederates of many hues at the time. Some were well-fixed and lived with families in rented houses. Others lived in hotels. The less affluent lived in cheap boarding houses. There were also former prisoners of war scrounging for meals and a bed. And, of course, there were others, hard-eyed and secretive, often using aliases, who came and went on mysterious Confederate business. The common thread was a fanatical hatred for all things Yankee. The St. Lawrence Hall was the unofficial Confederate clearinghouse and headquarters in Montreal. Here, one could pick up the latest war news, get mail from home, meet friends, and conduct whatever business was at hand. When Booth registered there, he dropped into a milieu of Little Richmond, unquote. He must have felt at home. Booth's Montreal visit is usually noted in historical accounts without any analysis. To assume that Booth went to Montreal merely to ship his theatrical wardrobe through the blockade to the South, the official version for his trip, is naive in the extreme, tantamount to believing in leprechauns. Federal detectives investigating Lincoln's assassination did not believe it for a moment. They were certain that Booth went there in connection with a conspiracy aimed at Lincoln. From Samuel Arnold's confession, they had evidence that the plan to capture Lincoln had been conceived at least 6 weeks before Booth's Montreal trip. From Joseph Simons, they knew that Booth closed out his oil operations in late September. But knowing something and being able to prove it with competent evidence are not the same. The Federals could not quite put it together. Pressed by Stanton to get on with the trial, Judge Advocate General Joseph Holt adopted a tactical approach. He would downplay schemes to kidnap Lincoln and focus on the assassination itself. This strategy had merit because any attempt by armed men to capture Lincoln could have ended in his death. In any case, Holt and his advisors simply rolled everything into one conspiracy to assassinate and asserted that its origins were in Canada and Richmond. The trial strategy was flawed by questionable testimony on key points, which allowed the Confederates and their Copperhead allies to launch an effective disinformation campaign after the war. It would have read as follows: John Wilkes Booth? Not one of ours, certainly. an actor fellow, wasn't he? Obviously a madman. Everybody knows that the death of Lincoln was the worst thing that could have happened to a defeated South. And look at the trial testimony of Sanford Conover, Charles A. Dunham, Godfrey Hyams, Dr. James B. Merritt, and Richard Montgomery. Perjury. Rank perjury. Unquote. Again, just snap some of the other lone nuts in here. Lee Harvey Oswald, not one of ours. No. Mm-mm. Continuing, by the way, Oswald didn't kill anybody. He was framed before he could defend himself. Framed and then killed before he could defend himself, as anybody who's done any serious research knows. Continuing. Repeated ad infinitum, this became truth. It obscured the Confederacy's plans, legitimate acts of war to make Lincoln a prisoner, and Booth's role in one such plan. Thus, an old political ploy became useful. Cover one transgression by denying a different one. No evidence has been found to show that Booth met with either Jacob Thompson or Clement C. Clay during his Montreal visit. These two were in Quebec City on the 14th of October seeking an interview with Governor-General Lord Monck. He refused to see them. They planned to leave there the next day. They would, of course, pass through Montreal, Thompson en route to Toronto, and Clay en route to St. Catharines. Clay was back in St. Catharines by October 19th. Thompson arrived at the Queen's Hotel in Toronto on October 21st. Where he was from the time he left Quebec on October 15th and the time he arrived back in Toronto has not been learned. Of course, the implication here is that both may very well have been meeting with John Wilkes Booth. Continuing. Shipping a theatrical wardrobe doesn't take 10 days. Federal investigators therefore wanted to know who Booth saw in Montreal and what they talked about. The trail was cold, local citizens were largely uncooperative, and the police were overtly hostile. The investigation came up short. Now, after more than a century, researchers are in a better position to collect the bits and pieces, to study the background of the protagonists, and to make an intelligent evaluation. There is solid evidence that Booth was in personal contact with two Confederate agents during his Montreal visit. They were Patrick C. Martin and George N. Sanders. Martin, a native of New York, had been a Baltimore liquor dealer. A letter in the War Department files dated July 24, 1862, protested government dealings with his firm, describing him as an uncompromising rebel of the 19th of April notoriety, unquote. One unconfirmed report is that he got into further difficulty with the Federals because of an act of piracy on Chesapeake Bay. More than likely, Martin was recruited by the Confederates as a blockade runner because of his earlier experience at sea. Regardless, he arrived in Montreal in the late summer of 1862 and immediately set up operations to buy and ship contraband to the south, plying small vessels between Montreal and Halifax. Later, this trade expanded to ocean-going traffic. Federal detectives intercepted a letter from Baltimore, dated the 12th of December of 1862, intended for a refugee in Montreal. One comment questioned Martin's integrity. Quote, "How do you like Mr. Martin? Keep a sharp lookout. I have been informed by several persons he is slippery and not as fair as he might be," unquote. Apparently, federal detectives were also keeping a sharp lookout for Martin, but there was no way they could reach him in Montreal. Martin continued to extend his contraband operations and arranged a loose partnership with Alexander Keith, Jr. of Halifax. There are numerous references to Martin in Confederate records and in the official records of the Union and Confederate navies. Three documents refer to him as Captain P.C. Martin, unquote, presumably as the master of a ship rather than one holding rank in the Confederate service. That Martin was an insider in the Confederate apparatus in Canada is made clear in a report dated the 2nd of February of 1864 by Captain Robert D. Minor, Confederate States Navy, to Admiral Franklin Buchanan. Captain Minor had been sent to Canada with 22 men and a plan to capture the federal gunboat Michigan on Lake Erie and free the Confederate prisoners on Johnson's Island. The scheme failed. Captain Minor's lucid report explained in detail what actions he took and why the attempt had to be abandoned. He also commented, quote, "Finding Marshal Kane and some of our friends in Montreal, we set to work to prepare and perfect our arrangements, the first object of the plan being to communicate with the prisoners on Johnson's Island, informing them that an attempt would be made to release them. This was effected through a lady from Baltimore, a Mrs. P.C. Martin, then residing with her husband and family in Montreal, and whose husband did all in his power to aid us in every way, unquote. Booth arranged for Martin to ship his theatrical wardrobe to Halifax and on south. Martin's chartered vessel, Marie Victoria, a 73-foot schooner built in 1858, left Montreal with cargo on November 18, 1864, bound for Halifax, Nova Scotia. Some 2 weeks later, she foundered in a storm and ran aground in Beek, Quebec. Presumably, all hands were lost in the icy waters of the St. Lawrence River, including Martin. Mrs. Martin was listed in a later city directory as a widow. Portions of Booth's wardrobe, badly damaged by salt water, were recovered from the wreck when salvage operations were taken in the spring of 1865. Booth and Martin had much more to talk about than shipping a theatrical wardrobe. There was the plan to abduct Lincoln. Martin had connections with the Confederate underground in Maryland. He gave Booth a letter of introduction to William Queen, an elderly physician who lived on the edge of the Zakiya Swamp, some 6 miles south of Bryantown in Charles County. The expectation was that Dr. Queen would assist Booth by lining up local support and escape routes through the area. The cover story was that Booth had an interest in buying land. Martin's letter of introduction set off a chain of events that almost sent Dr. Samuel A. Mudd to the gallows. In Montreal, Booth was also intimate with Kentuckian George Sanders. They were made for each other. Each was fanatical in his Southern sympathies, each held strong Republican views, and each looked upon Lincoln as a bloody tyrant. In addition, Sanders had a record of advocating political assassinations. Sanders, again an associate of Booth's in the planning, was still urging political assassinations when he came to Washington to monitor a high-level conference convened on February 4, 1861, to explore ways to avert civil war. In the Diary of a Public Man, Sanders is mentioned in the entry for the 28th of February. Here, the diarist reported a discussion held with President-elect Lincoln at Willard's Hotel. Quote, "I told him what I believe to be perfectly true, that the worst stories all originate with men like George Sanders of New York. They have been telling wonderful stories of conspiracy and assassination," unquote. Together with Clement C. Clay and James P. Holcomb, Sanders sought to arrange a peace conference in early July of 1864 at the Clifton House on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls. The idea was a good one, intended to embarrass Lincoln and influence the November election. Lincoln avoided any commitment, and the conference never took place. General John A. Dix, who commanded in New York, however, sent the head of his Secret Service, Colonel Ambrose Stevens, to the Clifton Hotel in civilian clothes. Colonel Stevens found the hotel filled with Confederate agents, copperheads, and peace Democrats. He reported to General Dix that one of the Confederate peace commissioners was urging a plan to assassinate Lincoln just before the November election to discourage the Republicans and cause electoral chaos. General Dix came to Washington to inform Lincoln of this plot. On Lincoln's orders, the matter was hushed up on the ground that publicity would do more harm than good. Skipping down. When John Wilkes Booth arrived at the St. Lawrence Hall in Montreal on October 18, 1864, George Sanders was staying at the Ottawa Hotel in that same city. The two must have met promptly. Various people saw them together frequently. Their discussions, however, were interrupted by the famous Confederate raid on St. Albans, Vermont, on October 19th of 1864. And skipping ahead, what we're going to look at next concerns how the plan to kill or to kidnap Abraham Lincoln and force the Confederacy to the Union rather to sue for peace morphed into a plan to kill Lincoln and throw the Northern political leadership into disarray. Of Colonel John Mosby. After Mosby disbanded his organization on April 21st, he and about 50 of his men started for the Richmond area. By 25th of April, they were camped at Frederick's Hall in Louisa County between Gordonsville and Hanover Junction. Capturing Lincoln was no longer feasible. Richmond was in Union hands. General Lee had surrendered. The project of blowing up the executive mansion to kill Lincoln was obviously out. No explosives experts had come to do it. But all was not lost. There were still Confederate armies in the field. Some dramatic action might yet save the Confederacy, and he, Booth, was the one to do it. This thought was expressed in his famous diary, unquote. For 6 months we had worked to capture, but our cause being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done, unquote. Just when the list of those to be assassinated was drawn up is uncertain, but it was probably the 12th or 13th of April. Three people were on the list: President Lincoln, Vice President Andrew Johnson, and Secretary of State William Seward. Why Seward? Here, Booth evidently had sound advice based on the premise set out by George Sanders in July of 1864, caused total discord in the electoral process. With Lincoln and Johnson both dead, the 1792 statute governing presidential succession would apply. The president pro tempore of the Senate, Lafayette Foster of Connecticut, would act as president until the Electoral College provided a new president. Under the law, the Secretary of State was required to set this process in motion. The infighting among the radical Republicans over the selection of a new Secretary of State and over control of the Electoral College is not hard to envision. Monumental confusion and chaos would reign. The South might regroup and fight on. This must have been on Booth's mind when he talked with a friend, Edward Person, on April 13th. He told Person he had, quote, the biggest thing on his hands that had ever turned up, unquote. Due to the limitations of time, we're going to have to attenuate some of this story. Suffice it to say that after Booth killed Lincoln, he appears to have been aided in his escape by the various Confederate Security Service that had put this special force in place to cover the force that was to capture Lincoln. And there's a map here showing the motions of Colonel John Mosby and the motions of John Wilkes Booth, and they move right toward one another. Continuing, there were some dangling threads about Mosby and all of this. When Booth and Harold were at Dr. Stewart's on April 23rd, they told him they wanted to go to Mosby, unquote, which implies an understanding of some sort. Further, both at the Port Conway Ferry and later at the Garrett's, there were negotiations about being taken to Orange Courthouse. After the Yankees moved out in early 1864, Orange County was considered to be Mosby territory. And of the disbanding of the security force that was in play, on August 1st, 1865, after the end of the war, Robert E. Lee wrote to Wade Hampton about the closing events of the war. He blamed the disaster at Five Forks and the shortage of cavalry caused by the reinforcements that he had sent with Hampton to the Carolinas during the winter of 1865. He further excused the cavalry who had been left in Virginia by saying, a large portion of the men who had been sent to the interior to winter their horses had not rejoined their regiments, unquote. It is correct that a large portion of the cavalrymen who had been sent home had not returned to their units, but they were in the northern neck and along the escape routes rather than in the interior, unquote. General Lee may have been giving a cover story. We find the evidence of the existence of the security force overwhelming. It involved a large number of men at a time when men were scarce. It was put together in a way to keep its existence secret even from the men who belonged to it, and it maintained a very low profile while on station. When it had served its purpose, it was dissolved as carefully as it had been formed. By May 10, 1865, the clandestine force had been completely dispersed, most of the men were in their homes, and the Union apparently never learned of its existence at all. Only the cryptic phrase, paroled at Ashland, remained to remind the veterans that they had won their last battle. And this concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 691, The Confederate Secret Service and the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This program is being recorded on September 26th of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.